this week's 51%, we speak with the authors of Private Violence, Latin American Women and the Struggle for Asylum, and learn why women fleeing gender-based violence have always struggled to win asylum in the U.S., even before the current Trump administration.
These women have a really difficult time meeting these criteria because their persecutor was not the government or government agencies.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. In his first weeks in office, President Trump has moved to increase deportations and effectively close the southern U.S. border to what he describes as an invasion of asylum seekers. As our guest today will tell us, many Latin American women who seek asylum in the U.S. do so to escape domestic or gang-related violence, and that comes with its own obstacles, because in the eyes of many in the U.S. immigration system, this is, quote, private violence, not state-sanctioned violence deserving of asylum, even though, as we'll hear, the home countries in these cases aren't often doing anything to protect women. Carol Cleveland and Michelle Waslin are the authors of Private Violence, Latin American Women and the Struggle for Asylum. Cleveland is an associate professor of social work at George Mason University, while Waslin is the assistant director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota. Over the past several years, they've interviewed more than 40 women seeking asylum in the U.S. Through interviews and eyewitness accounts of closed court proceedings, they demonstrate why it has long been difficult for these women to win asylum, even before the current Trump administration. Just a heads up that today's episode discusses domestic violence and sexual assault, and it might be upsetting for some listeners. If you or someone you love has been impacted by these issues, please know help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is open 24/7 by calling 1-800-799-SAFE, while RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline is 1-800-656-4673.
A colleague of mine who was a trauma expert asked me if I would be willing to do a pro bono psychosocial evaluation for a woman from El Salvador who had escaped having been trafficked into a brothel in El Salvador, had crossed the border without authorization, and then had been incarcerated for 6 months. And she needed asylum here in the United States. So I agreed to do that interview and to write the assessment for her to use in her evidentiary package in court. After that, some attorneys in the area asked me to do pro bono evaluations. And I began to wonder, why are there so many women from Central America and Mexico who need asylum in the United States on gender-based claims? Because the women I was meeting, had either suffered gang-related violence or domestic violence, all of it without the protection of law enforcement, feeling that they all had no recourse but to come to the United States. And they were filing gender-based claims in immigration court. So I observed some of these hearings, and I'm an ethnographer by training, which means I'm trained to observe rituals and processes in their social environment. So I began going to court to watch how these asylum claims played out. And I conceptualized this book that I thought would include interviews with the women, artifacts, as well as my ethnographic observation of court. And then I realized, you know what, asylum is extremely complicated. There are enormous legal questions. There are enormous policy questions. So I thought the help of a political scientist would be really invaluable to the project. And luckily, I knew a very capable one in Michelle, and she agreed to co-author the book with me, which was a blessing.
I recognize that there is so much misinformation about immigration out in the world. And I really loved this chance to tell these women's stories and to explain the context around this particular issue and to try to educate the American public about who asylum seekers are, why they're seeking asylum, and what kinds of obstacles they encounter when they come to the United States.
That actually kind of leads me into my next question here. I was thinking maybe we could start by talking a little bit about some of like the basics of the asylum process in general, you know, like who is eligible for it and for what reasons.
Right. And that's a fluid question. Asylum, and I'll let Michelle mostly talk about this, but it was a system designed in the aftermath of the Cold War to protect victims of state violence. So the classic, you know, what we've known most of our lives are people fleeing communism, like Cubans and Soviets who defected, as they used to say, who needed protection here and who asked for asylum. What's changed now is that we have people coming to the United States, including the women we talk about in this book, who need protection, not because the state persecuted them, but because the states that they come from are either incapable or unwilling to protect them from violence by private actors, such as the two major gangs that function in Central America, as well as Mexico. And that's who is now, well, the borders essentially is closed now. But when we were writing the book, that's who the women were who came. And I'd like to give Michelle a chance to speak.
Thanks, Carol. Yeah, so according to U.S. law, anybody can apply for asylum if they're within the United States. And it does not matter if they came here lawfully or unlawfully. It doesn't matter what their status is. You have the right to apply for asylum in the United States. And I think that that's a fact that gets forgotten in our current conversations about immigration. And the criteria are quite difficult to meet. You have to prove that you have been persecuted. You have to prove that you have a well-founded fear of persecution if you were to return to your home country. You have to prove that the abuse that you suffered rises to the level of persecution, right? You have to prove that you are part of one of the protected grounds, right? Like race, religion, gender is not a protected ground. Mm-hmm. So the women that we talk to have to prove that they're part of what's called a particular social group. And how that's defined and how that's interpreted has changed quite a bit over time. They also have to prove that they looked for help in their home country, but their home country was unable or unwilling to protect them. These are all really difficult legal standards to meet. And then on top of that, you have to prove to a judge that you're credible, right? That you're not lying, that you have evidence to back up everything that you're saying. And then the judge has to say, you know, yes, you have met all of these criteria and I will grant you asylum. That happens really rarely, to be honest. It's really difficult for anybody to meet these criteria. And as Carol said, these women who are fleeing domestic violence or gang violence often have a really difficult time meeting these criteria because their persecutor was not the government or government agencies in most cases, right? And that's why this has been called, quote unquote, private violence. We argue this is not private at all. This is systemic. This is cultural. This is national. And that the governments in these countries have been unwilling to protect these women. And therefore, they do qualify for asylum. And over the last couple of decades, there have been advances in immigration law. There have been important precedent set, legal decisions that said, yes, women who are victims of quote unquote private violence are eligible for asylum and they can meet these strict criteria. Unfortunately, under the first Trump administration, he closed that door, basically said, we're no longer going to recognize victims of private violence. They're no longer going to be eligible for asylum. When President Biden came into office, he overturned that again. right? So there's a lot of uncertainty because each administration makes different interpretations of the law. During his campaign and now, President Trump has made it very clear that he intends to fully close that door again, not only to women who are fleeing private violence, but he's really closing the door to all asylum seekers.
And I definitely want to talk about that a little bit later on, too. But I wanted to touch on something you kind of mentioned about, you know, about gender-based violence not meeting the criteria or not being like a protected grounds for seeking asylum in the U.S. I want to dig in a little bit into sort of like the different factors that play into that. As you mentioned, you know, this is private violence. This isn't state violence necessarily. But what are some of the other things going on that make it difficult to be, I guess, a protected grounds or a criteria here that can make you eligible for asylum?
If I could illustrate with one of the court cases I observed, then this was under the Biden administration, but there was a Salvadoran woman whom I met, and I wrote her psychosocial assessment, so I got to attend her court hearing. And this is one of the facets of the book I'd really like to highlight. These hearings are not necessarily open to the public. They're closed unless the person seeking asylum grants you permission to get in. So it's very difficult to observe an immigration court hearing for an asylum seeker. So we were very fortunate in that between the two of us, we witnessed 36 of them. But in one of those hearings, there was a Salvadoran woman who had been threatened by her then boyfriend, who had been a member of one of the gangs. She had not been able to receive any protection from his violence. He was arrested finally because he raped a 12-year-old. And so he's in a Salvadoran prison. While he's in prison, and this came out in the court testimony, he demanded conjugal visits from this lady. And during the conjugal visits, the guards watched and witnessed her being raped. And she describes this in detail in the court hearing. And during his deliberation, the judge stepped away and said, I'm going to need about 20 minutes to think about this. And he didn't rejoin us for another 45 minutes, and everyone, it's a virtual hearing, everyone's staring into screens looking tense. Mm-hmm. The judge said that he was going to grant asylum, but he would not have if it hadn't been for the fact that while these rapes were going on during the conjugal visits, the guards at the prison watched. And for that reason, he was willing to grant asylum. So I think that shows how difficult it is to thread that needle. Because had the guards not been watching or had this occurred outside of a prison, this lady, at least in this courtroom, would not have won asylum.
It's really difficult for these women to win asylum for a whole host of reasons. Like Carol said, sometimes they don't believe that the government refuses to protect the women. They say, well, you know, you should have gone to the police. You should have gotten a restraining order. Sometimes the women say, well, I went to the police and they laughed in my face, right? Sometimes they did get a restraining order and the man came back anyway. Another really picky part of asylum law is that you have to be a member of a protected class, like we discussed, and you have to prove that your persecution was because you were a member of that protected class. So some of these judges say, well, your husband didn't beat you because you're a member of a protected class. Your husband beat you because he's a terrible guy who likes to beat women. And that disqualifies them, right? So there are all kinds of ways that judges and the DHS attorneys make it really difficult for women to tell their stories and to meet these criteria. Also, these are women who have been traumatized. They don't speak English in most cases, right? They're not familiar with the U.S. legal system. Many women don't have attorneys. The ones that we spoke to were lucky enough to have an attorney, but many of these people applying for asylum are not represented by a lawyer, and so that makes it really difficult. And also, their trauma sometimes impacts their ability to tell their stories. Sometimes they confuse some of the details, or judges point out that they were inconsistent between the interview they first did the day they crossed the border several years ago and today. Maybe they got a date wrong, and the judge can use that against them.
What's sort of the political argument there, for, especially for the back and forth that we've had from administration to administration, but why is considering gender-based violence grounds for asylum, or, you know, or even granting asylum to people who have been victims of gang violence, like, why is that such a political baton?
Well, that's open to speculation. Mm-hmm. As far as it, in my particular opinion, I believe it's just part of the racialized narrative that's part of the MAGA movement and the Trump administration, that we don't want people from Central America and Mexico crossing our borders and seeking to become included in the United States social fabric. So one way we can close the door is to say that we're going to interpret asylum in a very narrow way, or we may not allow asylum claims, period, which has been batted around, which would really put us off the global stage, because asylum is it's always contested, but it is recognized as part of international law that, you know, in order to not violate human rights, you have to allow people to at least ask for asylum. You don't always have to give it. They have to meet all the criteria that Michelle did such a great job describing. But I believe, you know, this is just an effort by the Trump administration to keep Central Americans and Mexicans away from the country and to allow for their exclusion.
Yeah, I would just say that the United States has always had restrictions on immigration, including refugee admissions and asylum. While the law clearly states that we can grant asylum to people who meet the criteria, there have always been efforts in place to try to limit the number. There's always this concern about opening the floodgates, and if you let one person get it, then many, many more people are going to follow. So I don't think that this is anything particularly new, although the degree, the extent to which the Trump administration is going after asylum and asylees is quite unprecedented. You know, with Central America in particular, the U.S. has always had this relationship with our countries that are close, that neighbor us, and we have influenced these countries in many ways, economically, militarily, throughout the decades. And there's always been this concern that too many of them are going to try to come to the United States. Mm-hmm. So I believe that these restrictions on asylum are part of this continuing effort to severely limit the number of people from the Western Hemisphere that are coming to the United States.
I mean, one of the problems I think that Michelle just touched on is when you think of a country like Guatemala or El Salvador, we wage civil wars by proxy in both of these countries. In Guatemala, it was 36 years long, and we funded these civil wars. We gave money. When those civil wars ended, these countries were just awash in firearms. There were a lot of disenfranchised young men who had no purpose, no sense of belonging. And so gang membership became the route to which many men have found this purpose, meaning in life, an ability to generate income. Of course, gangs are hyper-masculine organizations. Then the assault of women is venerated in gang membership. But you know, we have to remember we created these conditions, or at least we certainly strongly contributed to them.
And what does this mean for the women that you interviewed? You know, if they don't get asylum, like, what happens?
What happens next for them is an order of removal. And we watched court hearings where women were ordered removed, and the judge warns them that if, you know, they receive a warrant and they don't show up, that they're, you know, subject to fines. At this point, ICE can then go and arrest them and have them forcibly deported. Now, in practice, many of these women did not face removal because they weren't a priority. They weren't criminals. Primarily, ICE had been focused on removing criminals. I don't know if under the Trump administration, if in fact they're going to be more aggressive and look up who's received an order of removal and is still here. And that's one of the worries I have going into this administration, that they'll start combing through and saying that someone who, yeah, she lost her asylum claim, but she hasn't committed any crimes. She's working. She's just going on about her business and trying to live her life as best she can, might be subject to removal. And given the fact that she came here because she was at risk of very severe violence, which is what people talk about to prove they were persecuted, they could be removed to a situation where they will suffer re-injury and possibly even death. And I don't say that with hyperbole.
Yeah, these are absolutely life and death matters. I agree with everything Carol just said. And I want to add, we have to remember that the women that we interviewed had entered the United States quite a while before we interviewed them. Right now, there is such a backlog of these asylum cases that if you enter the country and you apply for asylum, you're given a hearing date that could be 5-6 years down the line. In the meantime, asylum seekers do have the ability to apply for work authorization. So these women were known to the government. They have work authorization. They're working. They're setting down roots. They're making friends. They're becoming part of the community. And all of this while they're waiting for their hearing. So there's so much uncertainty, not knowing what the outcome of that hearing is going to be. If they are denied asylum, they have the right to appeal that decision, which could take even longer to resolve. At the end of this entire process, if they're denied asylum, they've probably already been here in the country close to 10 years. Many of these women now have set down roots. They own homes. They have friends. Many of these women get married. They have children who are U.S. citizens, right? They're part of our communities. So to disrupt that and to deport them back to a possibly deadly situation in their home country after they've had this, you know, many years here in the United States is really heartbreaking. And I think that's another huge problem with our current system that many people don't understand.
We've touched on it a little bit, but I'd like to dig into a little bit of some of the efforts of the current administration. I mean, in just the first few weeks, we've seen the president, you know, try to push more for deportations as well as, you know, attack birthright citizenship, basically just trying to stop things at the border. You know, how is this different than perhaps the first administration from what we've seen so far?
Well, one of the aspects of this that people forget, because Trump campaigned on this, you know, Joe Biden had an open border and Kamala Harris let anyone through and she failed as the border czar and all of that, which was, you know, frankly, fallacious, right? It simply was untrue. Joe Biden really hardened the border during his campaign. He started to meter out how many people could actually ask for asylum each day. So we've already had a slowing down to a trickle of the asylum system.
Yeah, I think that this president saw this as his winning issue, believes that he has a very strong mandate to end immigration as we know it, and he is going to use every tool in the toolbook to do so. And this is possible because our legislature, Congress, has not passed new immigration laws for a really long time. They've been unable to get a consensus on almost anything. So what they do instead is appropriate more and more money for enforcing these laws that are, quite frankly, out of date and ineffective. So we're spending a lot of money on enforcement for decades now, enforcing these laws that were written many, many decades ago and aren't consistent with our current reality. And Congress also realized they don't want to have to deal with these details of immigration every single day. So they gave the president, the executive branch, a lot of discretion over immigration. So the president is able to do executive orders, proclamations, set what priorities they want to set for immigration enforcement. Like I was saying with the court decisions, those are under the Department of Justice, the courts. They're part of the executive branch, so they can interpret the laws in different ways. They can send out memos and guidance to all the people who work on immigration enforcement. So there are many, many ways that the president is able to make policy changes. Now, some of what they are doing, a lot of what they are doing, I believe is illegal, and there will be challenges. I'm not saying that the president has the absolute authority to do whatever he wants to do, but they're certainly using every tool in the toolbook to try to restrict immigration and deport people. You know, they're really bound by how many resources they have. How many people can you possibly deport given a fixed amount of money, a fixed number of detention spaces, a fixed number of judges? Because people do have due process and they have the right to challenge these decisions. But that just adds to the backlogs and adds to the length of the process. So, I think that we are going to continue to see the executive branch try to restrict immigration, including legal immigration, of course, and asylum is legal. We're going to continue to see that, and we're going to continue to see states and localities trying to do everything they can to ramp up this deportation effort. But we're also seeing a lot of people and states and localities saying, no, we are not going to assist the federal government with these efforts. We're going to push back against the federal government. And I think the American people are really going to get a sense of how important immigrants are to our communities and to our economy.
Yeah, and if I could just add, you know, what we get into in granular detail in our book, Private Violence, is we describe the conditions that the women escaped from. We describe the work that they did, the poverty that they lived in. Unfortunately, there is descriptions of the violence they suffered, but it was necessary to tell that story. We describe their Herculean efforts that they had to take to just get across the border safely, the deception used by human smugglers that they suffered. We get into granular detail about what the conditions are in immigration detention at the border, including, you know, being held in freezing cold cells. We describe the after effects of the trauma. And then we describe also, though, the incredible agency and resilience of the women as they fought their way through the court system, hired attorneys, gathered evidence, worked, found jobs, made meaning of their lives in circumstances of enormous adversity that, you know, really are difficult to even wrap your head around.
Carol Cleveland and Michelle Waslin are the authors of Private Violence, Latin American Women and the Struggle for Asylum. It's out now through New York University Press. If you or someone you love has been impacted by domestic violence, please know help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is open 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. And RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline is 1-800-656-4673. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcasts.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.